ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of arts and culture news from across the globe. I'm Sky Kirkham. And this week, we're diving into the university sector. Arts degrees are expected to cost $55,000 next year, but despite the cost to students, we're seeing restructures, closures, and redundancies at one university after another. And you've been hearing about the strain between the tertiary sector and the arts on this show all year, as, for example, Mianjin was shuttered by the University of Melbourne and the Bendigo Writers' Festival faced blowback from authors when La Trobe made last-minute demands that the writers felt impacted their freedom of speech. So what's gone wrong? What's the impact for both universities and the arts? And is there a path back to better news? Coming up, you'll hear from George Williams, the Vice-Chancellor of Western Sydney University, and Claire Wright, historian, author, and academic at La Trobe. But first, the headlines with C. Benedict. C, welcome. A free Amel and the Sniffers gig was cancelled at the last minute in Fed Square in Melbourne.
Yeah, good morning, Sky. It was a last-minute surprise gig for free in the centre of Melbourne. Amel and the Sniffers are one of the hottest names in Australian music, and the crowd swelled to well over capacity, hundreds of fans pushing through security barriers at the venue. That meant that the gig was over before the first note was played. Katrina Sedgwick, who's the CEO of Melbourne Arts Precinct Corporation, has apologised to the band and to fans. She said, because of the large group of people pushing in through the perimeter after the event was full, it was not possible to control the site, and we were not prepared to have an event that was a real risk of crowd crush. Fans might have been disappointed, but Amel and the Sniffers came out of things looking like hometown heroes after they donated their fee for the event by putting $5,000 on the bar tab at seven gig venues across Melbourne.
That's certainly a way to win new fans and keep everyone on side. And see, the APY Arts Centre Collective is suing the Australian's publisher for defamation.
Yes, this is a story we've touched on here at Arts in 30 many times this year. The so-called white hands on black art reporting by The Australian began in 2023, with the APY Arts Centre Collective since having faced four separate inquiries, none of which have substantiated the reporting by Nationwide News and journalist Greg Bearup. Now, according to court filings, the APY Arts Centre Collective has alleged Nationwide News and Greg Bearup defamed the internationally recognised organisation in 33 newspaper articles. They are seeking a $4.4 million payout.
And that's certainly one we'll keep an eye on as it goes forward. In other news, the Pope has opinions on Peak TV.
Yeah, of course he does. In a meeting with Hollywood actors and directors, Pope Leo urged the protection of local cinemas and spoke to the importance of the shared cultural activity of seeing a movie together. He also warned against a flattening of culture, saying that the logic of algorithms tends to repeat what works, but art opens up what is possible. He urged filmmakers to defend slowness, silence, and difference when telling their stories. Thank you very much, Chicago Pope.
Indeed, and strong agree on your taste in cinema, Chicago Pope, as well as Spike Lee handed him a yet another jersey to add to the collection, this one from the New York Knicks.
Incredible.
See, one of the current greats in speculative fiction has been acknowledged with a very fancy title.
Yes, N.K. Jemisin has been named the 42nd Damon Knight Memorial Grand Master by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association. It's an award that acknowledges lifetime achievement in the field. The president of the SFWA, Kate Ristow, said, "We don't write in a vacuum. We write in a world of complexity and trauma. Jemisin helps us hold a mirror up to our darkest fears and our deepest desires. Jemisin shows us that storytelling is not just an escape, it's a powerful tool for engagement in our own reality. Through her work, she reminds us that speculative fiction can be both a space for resistance and a landscape for transformation."
Indeed, and well-deserved congratulations to N.K. Jemisin. See, what else is making news?
Well, Madonna Duffy has been appointed as the director of UQP, the University of Queensland Press. Duffy had been UQP's publishing director and acting director, so it's a continuation of sorts, but the publisher will now be looking for a new publishing director. Returning to Melbourne this year after a five-year absence, Asia Topa was awarded the 2025 Melbourne Award for Arts and Events. a major production of Aida designed by Franco Zeffirelli and due to be performed in Adelaide next year has been delayed until at least 2027 after complications with transporting the massive sets across the world. Refunds have been offered to ticket holders. Recently released financial documents show that Tasmania's Museum of Old and New Art, or MONA, has run at a loss of $408 million since it opened in 2011. Despite this, the founder David Walsh has said he's completely happy with the finances. MONA will never make money and it was never intended to. If I wanted to make money, I would have built it in Sydney or Istanbul or somewhere. Homayoun Ashadi has died of cancer at the age of 78. The Iranian architect and actor rose to prominence when he starred in Kiarostami's classic film, The Taste of Cherry. He went on to appear in dozens of other films, including The Kite Runner and Zero Dark Thirty.
And I had a chance to rewatch Taste of Cherry recently. It is an absolutely brilliant film and an outstanding lead performance. So if you haven't seen it, now is a good time to go and celebrate the life and work of Ashadi. C, thank you very much.
Thanks, Guy.
You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham. The last few years have been rough for the arts and humanities in higher education. Degrees remain expensive for students, with the Job Ready Graduates program pushing the costs of an arts degree up to $55,000. And despite the cost to students, it seems like almost every piece of news coming from the universities is about cuts and restructures. In 2025, ANU announced plans to restructure their School of Music, the Humanities Research Centre, and more. Macquarie announced plans to end their music and ancient language degrees and more, with dozens of cuts in the arts faculty. University of Tasmania announced restructures and job cuts in the arts, though committed to retaining the areas. Restructures were recommended at QUT, including an end to their dance school. Anecdotally, cuts to sessional positions are significant across universities, with full-time academics expected to take on more of a teaching load, leaving fewer opportunities for emerging teachers. Outside the course structures, universities have always been deeply embedded in the arts, but that's had its own set of challenges this year. La Trobe was involved with the Bendigo Writers Festival, where more than 50 guests pulled out after last-minute demands to sign a code of conduct that included advice that speakers, quote, avoid language or topics that could be considered inflammatory, divisive, or disrespectful, and also included the University of Australia's definition of anti-Semitism. The University of Melbourne has ended the literary magazine Meanjin after 85 years with no attempt to preserve the magazine, and Monash University postponed the Stolen Earth art show featuring the work of Khaled Sabsabi at MUMA, claiming that through consultation with our communities, we have identified there is a need for the museum to deepen its collaboration and engagement. That's all this year, and it's not a comprehensive list. If I stretch back to 2020, we might not have time for an actual conversation. So what's going wrong? Is this just a necessary readjustment driven by market forces? Has the sector lost its way? Or do we need to look at the relationship between government funding and universities? George Williams is the Vice Chancellor and President of Western Sydney University and the author of Aiming Higher, Universities and the Future of Australian Democracy. George, welcome.
Thank you.
I'd be curious to begin with your perspective on the role of universities when it comes to the arts. From the outside, it seems like funding decisions and degree costs have kind of pushed them to the periphery at many institutions. But what is the role of a university in the arts ecosystem, in your view?
Well, it's quite a list you read out there of what's been happening this year. And I think it does suggest something is going very wrong in this area, because my perspective is the arts, the humanities, are the bedrock of a great university education. And if you think about what defines us as institutions, it's about critical thinking. It's about being able to deal with uncomfortable issues, out of your comfort zone. It's about actually being able to engage with those big societal questions. And what better place to do that than a philosophy, history, English literature, you name it, degree. And I think the devaluing of those degrees in Australia over a long period of time now is not only wrong-headed, it's actually quite harmful to us as a nation. So I think unis, well, we've got to be there. We've got to recognise the importance of these degrees, spruik them, and get students into what will be great careers on the back of that education.
Yeah, looking at your own institution, earlier this year you announced that Western Sydney University was expecting a $76 million deficit in next year and that you have no choice but to reduce the workforce by 300 to 400 positions. That's not art-specific, that's across the university. This is clearly an issue that's going far beyond the arts at the moment. What's causing that problem? What's going on at our universities?
And then that's right. In our case, we've been beset by the same financial pressures as other unis. And fortunately, we've got to a position where, yes, about half that in terms of job losses, no forced redundancies, and, you know, no deprioritisation of the arts either. But what's happening across the sector is this year alone, to add to your list, probably about 3,000 or so job losses across the sector. That's partly because of limits on the number of international students that universities are able to take. They cross-subsidise pretty much everything at universities these days. And if you go back even further, universities are built upon a model put in place in the 1980s during the Hawke government. At that point, they decided they wanted to greatly increase the number of university students. That's a good thing to provide access. But they also felt that the taxpayer wouldn't pay for it. So they corporatised universities, increased student fees, introduced HECS, which did away with the free tuition that the Whitlam government had introduced. And so from 1989, we moved to a new system of students paying what became an increasingly high amount for their university courses. And that's worked from a government point of view. Back in the 80s, governments put in 80% of university funding. Now it's 40%. So they have halved the percentage of government funding and the number of students has tripled in the sector. But that's been at a cost, and that cost has been corporatisation and a big focus on revenue, because without that external revenue, simply universities can't add the money up and jobs get lost.
Well, in terms of that cost and the reliance on foreign students, you note in your book that in 95, the federal government spent 0.9% of GDP on universities, but that's dropped by a third to 0.6% in 2021. What does that mean in practical terms? And have universities done enough to resist it? I mean, I'm sure they haven't been thrilled, but is there more that the sector can and should be doing to argue its case for the value of government investment?
I think there is more we can do, and the figures are very stark. That's right, going down from a bit under 1% of GDP to 0.6% of GDP, that's a big drop in how much we invest in higher education in Australia. It sends a very strong signal about what we prioritise as a nation, and universities aren't it and haven't been so for a long period of time. And universities do need to get income from other sources just to survive. I think we could have done more. I think if you go back to the 80s and the like, we've gone along for the ride without recognising the big impacts this has on students and also upon the nation. If you devalue universities and the arts, you devalue really important things about our democracy and what we stand for. But particularly, I think, with the Job Ready Graduates package in 2021, where the student fees were really increased massively, I don't think as a sector we fought that hard enough. I think we rolled over in many cases. And I think we're paying a price for that today, and the arts in particular. They're the biggest casualty of a fee system that says we devalue and don't really give the arts the credit they deserve.
Well, can we step into that? Because I think I kind of know the answer to this, but I think it is a question a lot of people would ask, which is, when it comes to the Job Ready Graduates package and the cost of degrees, students are now paying more for an arts degree than they were previously. Why does that then have the flow-on effect of closures? Why doesn't a degree that seems more expensive to the people doing it lead to universities being more enticed to offer the subjects and fund the subjects?
And you'd hope that might have been the case, that we put up arts. The current cost is it'll go up to $55,000 for your three-year arts degree, whereas maths, only $15,000. Or so. That's a big difference, 55,000 to 15,000. And of course, if you simply had the same number of students choosing to do arts, well, great, then you'd actually have income coming through to the uni. But it doesn't work that way. In fact, it's designed not to work that way. It's not designed to bring in extra income. It's designed to encourage students not to study the humanities. That was explicitly what the government sought to do. It said, we don't value the humanities. We want students to choose something else. But of course, what's happened is that the students don't easily flip between, let's say, philosophy and maths. Students just don't make those choices. In fact, less than one in 50 students are choosing to do something else. What we're seeing instead is students are saying, well, my real passion is the arts, but I'm not going to pay $55,000. They just don't go to uni in many cases. They are priced out of university. And these most typically are students from poorer backgrounds, mature age women, Indigenous students. So the very students who we most want to get into higher education, the most who benefit from social mobility, we're pricing them out of uni altogether.
And looking long term, one of the big challenges, I think, around this is that restructures can be temporary. But once a faculty is gone, it seems really hard to bring it back. And George, correct me if I'm wrong, but Western Sydney University got rid of its fine arts degree around 2008. Now, this is well before your time. In 2019, the university did acknowledge that the arts were really important and launched Western Sydney Creative, which has done some great work in the arts ecosystem. But as far as I can tell, there isn't still a fine arts, a visual arts school at Western Sydney University. How hard does it become to bring something back once it's been shut down?
Look, it's very hard and very expensive, of course, to re-employ the talent, get things set up again. And I think you're right. What you see increasingly is this roller coaster ride. More down than up, I'd have to say, though, sadly, in this area. And yes, once you stop investing in something, it gets very difficult, particularly in this cash-strapped climate. I would say that we're bucking the trend, at least at Western Sydney Uni in one area. We closed our performing arts degree 18 years ago, and we've just decided this year we're reintroducing it from next year.
Oh, great.
We think Western Sydney needs a performing arts degree. We'll cross-subsidise it. It's exactly what the community is demanding, a great performing arts education. So that will be expensive, but we are making the decision to do it. But that would be a counter-narrative to where you started and very unusual. But for that, you've got to prioritise students and social licence, because if it's just a financial calculus, well, the arts, they don't cut it a lot of the time, given the way the funding and the like is set up.
Well, it's great to hear that good news in the sector. George, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure.
George Williams there, the Vice-Chancellor and President of Western Sydney University and the author of Aiming Higher, Universities and the Future of Australian Democracy, which is a really fascinating book, and it's available now for you to check out yourselves. Now to a point of view from the ground, from someone involved in both teaching and being part of the arts ecosystem. Professor Claire Wright is a historian, an author, and a broadcaster. She's a professor of history and a professor of public engagement at La Trobe University. Her latest book, Naku Daruk, has won a slew of awards and is shortlisted for the Walkley. Claire, welcome.
Thanks very much, Skye.
Let's begin actually just going to the vibe on the ground, if we can. As someone working in the humanities, as someone who was involved with the situation around the Bendigo Writers Festival, what's it feel like to be part of the tertiary sector at the moment around the arts?
I'm a glass half full kind of a gal, always have been. I've been at La Trobe for over 20 years now and have been a very happy camper there. But I've got to say the mood on the ground is pretty grim. Some would go as far as to say it's a complete bin fire. Others would say the long timers like myself would say that it's the worst they've seen for many years. And then those who are newer to the industry, it's just actually all they've ever known. This form of precarity around employment, a sense of timidity around public engagement and public issues, and certainly the sense that the sector is shrinking and that the attention paid towards the humanities has never been slimmer.
Yeah. The university sector suggests that a reduction in government funding, the Job Ready Graduates program, things like that have led to a situation where hard decisions need to be made and money needs to be pulled back from sectors. And it does seem that that tends to be the arts more often than not. What's your response as someone working there? Is enough effort being made to argue for the importance of that sector?
Well, it depends on who's doing the arguing. Whether if you're talking about upper management, probably not. The people who are putting together strategic plans, if you're talking about at council or senior executive level, I don't think the arts and humanities are being emphasised and the value of them nearly enough. Obviously, the Jobs Ready Graduates program was a complete kick in the pants to the industry. And you would also then say that the current government hasn't done enough to roll that back. The Albanese was very critical of Jobs Ready graduates when they were in opposition, but we haven't seen the moves that would suggest that there was walk to be added to that kind of, crossbench talk or across the other side of the house talk at the time. This is something that a few of us tried to highlight when I was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Awards earlier this year, and all of us shortlistees in the Australian History category made a public statement on the night, including the winner, Geraldine Feeler, to suggest that it was all very well highlighting this achievements and generously rewarding the achievements of certain of us who are publishing in the Australian history field. But there weren't going to be people there to teach Australian history and to study Australian history if more structural reform did not happen on the ground floor and at the university level. And this is, I think, what younger people in particular, younger academics coming into the field, are arguing very strongly, and certainly the ones who are at the coalface teaching students or wanting to teach students but losing courses left, right and centre, and losing colleagues left, right and centre every time a new belt tightening exercise occurs, or another set of voluntary redundancies, which I've just seen at my university happen, or another what's euphemistically called organisational restructure happens. We've had at least four of those in the last 12 years at La Trobe, and every time there's new so-called course architecture and belt tightening measures, we seem to lose more and more of our humanities colleagues and courses.
It feels like we're seeing universities becoming increasingly risk averse when it comes to the language that, or the arguments that they're prepared to be a part of, whether it is the Bendigo Writers' Festival, whether it's Meanjin at the University of Melbourne. What does it do to someone like you, who then has to be the person to turn around and say, no, I'm not going to appear at that Writers' Festival if there isn't that freedom of academic speech?
It's a terrible situation to be put in. I'll be clear. I was the co-curator of the Bendigo Writers' Festival. I curated 9 sessions under the La Trobe Presents banner this year. I did 11 last year and 17 sessions the year before, working very closely with the then director, Rosemary Sorensen. And this was an opportunity, as the Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe, to provide a forum for other La Trobe academics and staff and alumni and adjuncts who are writers and who are publishing books to have a public platform and have a public outlet for their writing and their ideas, and to do that in collaboration with other writers. It's who live in the wider eco-literary and political and cultural sphere. And this has been a very important partnership that really did come a cropper this year when it was suggested that there was going to be restrictions placed on what the people who were participating in those sessions could say. And in particular, the focus was on one writer, Randa Abdel Fattah, who I had programmed to speak on a panel called On Reckoning, that was about colonial violence and the legacies of colonial violence. And she was going to be speaking on her new novel, Discipline, which ironically is about academic freedom, And this was going to be the first Writers' Festival that she was able to speak about that book at. She was on with two other writers, Paul Daly and Catherine Biber, who were speaking about First Nations colonial violence and the narrative and historical legacies from that time. And it was going to be a broad panel discussion, and there was pushback against it from a Zionist organisation. And immediately when that flag was raised, there was this issue of risk and of risk mitigation. And I would argue, as I did right from the very outset with my vice chancellor and chancellor, that there were risks on both sides, and that maybe the proper risk wasn't being addressed. And that was the risk of what would happen if academic freedom and freedom of speech among the literary community was seen to be being gagged in any way, and the sort of response that would come. And I said right from the start that if Rhonda walked from the festival, that I would too. And that I suspected that many other writers would also not consider it in their best interests to appear as well for their own moral choices that they would make. That was always a risk. The university chose to face that risk as above the sort of risk they might have had in the media getting hold of the fact that Rhonda was going to appear at our festival. This is the thing about risk, is that you're always weighing the risks, and therefore there are choices that have to be made. And then people in the higher echelons of the university are the ones ultimately who are going to be making those choices. So I think that's where values come into it, where principles come into it, and where what you're saying is the intersection between these large organisations of higher education that have always run on certain principles are butting up against other forms of corporate governance. And, you know, I understand that. I also chair the National Museum of Australia, and the role that I play there is very different from the role that I play as an academic employed by La Trobe University. And so I understand governance. I understand risk mitigation. I understand the necessity for doing that and for having good governance and good practices around these things. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's always about the choices that you make.
Certainly. And for more on the Bendigo Writers Festival, you can check out our interview with Rhonda Abdel-Fattah, which happened when the festival, the drama around the festival occurred earlier this year on the ABC Listen app. Claire, before I let you go, you said at the start you're a glass half full person. I think that'd be a good point to finish on. Mm. From a glass half full perspective, what could change or continue that would improve the situation, that would bring that relationship between the arts and the universities back together again? What would you like to see happen?
I think that there's a few stages in that, and we've been talking about things working on a number of levels. Mm. I would ultimately like to see universities show more courage, more and more fortitude in the way that they defend academic freedom, and in particular in their capacity and commitment to undergoing and supporting robust conversations that do not shy away from the issues of the day, such as the genocide in Gaza. I think it would be the worst case scenario if universities, like other arts organizations, just start to say it's too hard, it's too complicated, it's better not to host those sorts of conversations in the first place, so that we don't, and to invite the sort of speakers who can be, through no fault of their own, seen as being lightning rods for public debate or discussion or media attention. And that becomes a kind of implicit silencing of those voices. And universities should have the courage to be able to platform those voices. On the broader issue of the humanities in the university sector, I think, again, that senior executives have to be able to advocate for the arts and humanities. And that it, that in many, like in many things, it's a build and they come situation. you know, if there are always resources to go around, and of course there are external factors that surround universities' choices about where they're going to put their funding, but putting them into industry partnerships, into effectively, you know, supporting projects that are STEM-based in one way or another, whether that's widgets, apps, or bots, or AI. I'm not suggesting we cut back on funding of important scientific research or the research coming out of the sciences, but it always needs to be balanced with research that's being put into the humanities, because if universities don't value the role of the arts and humanities in society and the place of its graduates in those fields, who else is going to? And they have to be the ones that are shouting the loudest from the barricades, particularly to government, to do things like roll back the Jobs Ready graduate program, which would reverse the decline in enrolments in the humanities.
Well, indeed. Claire, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Professor Claire Wright there. Claire is a historian, author, broadcaster, and a professor of history and professor of public engagement at La Trobe University. Her latest book, Naku Daruk, is out now. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham, and every week we invite an expert from across the ABC's music networks to showcase one special song for you, our track of the week. This week, Gab Burke, Take 5 producer on Double J, joins me. Gab, welcome. You've got a great pick for us this week as part of Oz Music Month.
Yes, I do. It is Bernard Fanning with a new old song, as in this is an old song, but a new version of it. It's Watch Over Me, featuring Casey Chambers and Claire Bowditch.
So what's changed this time around? What's he brought to this version of the song?
Well, originally it was released on his debut solo album, Tea and Sympathy, 20 years ago. Can you believe that album is 20?
Long? That's mad.
You know, the one with I Just Want to Wish You Well. It's that album, and this was one of the big hits from it. And Bernard did a special live performance of this song back in 2006. It was at the Arias because the song had been nominated for Single of the Year. And he played this song and was joined on stage by Casey Chambers and Claire Bowditch. It's the only time they ever, you know, sang this song together, and it was a special one-off live performance. But earlier this year, in celebration of the album's and the song's 20th anniversary, he got Casey and Claire.
Got the band back together.
Yeah, got them in a studio to record it so they could officially release it. And this is it. And of the song, Bernard said, I love this new version and can't wait for you to hear the spine-tingling three-part harmony at the end. Making music with friends is always a joy, but these are two of the kindest and most generous people I know, and I love them both dearly, despite their relentless bullying of my hair.
And what a remarkable collection of Australian talent on one track. Gab, can you throw to our track of the week, please?
Yes, please. This is Bernard Fanning featuring Casey Chambers and Claire Bowditch. The song is Watch Over Me.
Trouble fills my world, you bring me peace. You calm me down, you're my release. When walls come crashing down around my feet, you light my way, you're my release. Say you watch over me when I'm in too deep, and tell me you'll always be there to pull me free. On my brow, you are my shade, you cool me down, and
That was Watch Over Me by Bernard Fanning, featuring Casey Chambers and Claire Bowditch, the track chosen by our music correspondent, Gab Burke. And that's all the time we have for today. Arts in 30 is produced by me, Sky Kirkham. C. Benedict is our executive producer. Sound engineering by Ross Richardson. If you missed anything in the show today, you can find all of our interviews online on the ABC Listen app. Just look for Arts in 30. And remember to join us on the ABC Listen app every Friday for the Arts in 30 Weekender, where we bring you our tips on what to check out and what to skip from the world of the arts. I'm Sky Kirkham, and I'll catch you next time here on Arts in 30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.